Good morning. It is 7:49 and you are listening to Raven Radio, KCAW Sitka. Today is Monday, August 13th, 2012. I'm Holly Keene and this is Raven News. The fishing vessel Evening Star, which sank a week ago near Sitka, has slipped from its original position and is now believed to be under more than 300 feet of water. The state reported the change in the vessel's position Friday afternoon. There was no new information available as of Sunday night. Earlier last week, the 50-foot Evening Star was bowed down with the stern visible about 10 feet below the surface. It went down on August 2nd while fishing in Slocum Arm in western Chichikov Island, some 40 miles northwest of Sitka. The State Department of Environmental Conservation reported that an oil spill response team arrived shortly after noon on Friday. It found a large expanding sheen on the water. And Friday's report said that the sheen measured at 1.5 miles long, up from earlier reports about a mile. When responders arrived, the stern of the Evening Star was no longer visible, and it was presumed the boat shifted and slipped into deep water. The response team members searched with a depth sounder and now believe they're located the boat in about 300 to 400 feet of water, according to the state report. Oil booms were deployed to protect nearby fishing streams, and sonar was set to arrive over the weekend to survey and confirm the location of the Evening Star. The vessel is believed to have had about 1,000 gallons of diesel aboard when it sank, in addition to 25 gallons of lube oil and a hydraulic tank with a capacity of 160 gallons. The anticipated bulk of tsunami debris from Japan's March 2011 earthquake is not here yet. But observers have already spotted items coming ashore, pushed by North Pacific winds. Some of that debris might be unhealthy if consumed by coastal wildlife. A comprehensive survey of the outer coastline is underway. Matt Miller has more from Juneau.
We're seeing a lot of foam. We're seeing a lot of these buoys, and we are seeing what appears to be sections, a few sections of wall or construction or buildings. Some of them, you can see this urethane foam that's been sprayed on the inside.
That's Wasilla-based pilot Tim Veenstra describing recent flights along the south central coast. As head of Airborne Technologies Incorporated, he flies an amphibious Cessna 185 that skims as low as 700 feet off of the beach while dodging poor weather and sensitive wildlife areas.
It's a two-man operation. We've got the pilot up front and then the camera operator in the back that is running the equipment. Everything is tied together with GPS. It's all digital imagery.
High-definition video and high-resolution still cameras are mounted in the belly of the aircraft.
If there's a piece of foam that's about the size of a golf ball, we can typically define that as, yes, that is definitely a piece of foam.
Veenstra is on a state contract to fly and photograph 3,000 miles of outer coastline from Cape Mouzon in the southeast out to Cold Bay in the west before the first big wave of tsunami debris washes up on Alaska shores. The black polyurethane oyster buoys, large styrofoam floats, and other foam pieces seen on beaches are likely wind-driven, arriving earlier than submerged or current-driven objects. Veenstra is very careful to avoid identifying any of the debris he's seen as from last year's tsunami. That will require collection and examination by people on the beach. For example, he overflew two sites that had rather odd concentrated collections of debris.
On these beaches, hundreds of them were these black fly swatters with a white sports logo in the center of it. In addition, we've been seeing hundreds of Nerf size basketballs.
Later, they discovered that they were contents of containers that washed overboard from a freighter. Veenstra's contract with the State Department of Environmental Conservation is the first recent aerial survey of Alaska beaches, but it's not the first survey overall. The Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation recently issued a report on contractors patrolling Kodiak, Yakutat, Sitka, and Craig beaches last winter. Alaska scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have been walking southeast and Prince William Sound beaches this summer. Elaine Bussey Floyd is the acting director of DEC's Division of Environmental Health, and she says the state is paying nearly $200,000 for the aerial survey. A potential grant from NOAA will likely go to actual cleanup.
If they notify us of the grant award, then our plan with that money is to contract it out in the marine debris community so that the money is used for boots or boats on the ground to actually remove the tsunami debris.
But that NOAA grant is only $50,000.
That's a start.
Dave Gaudette, Marine Debris Program Coordinator for the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation, says cleaning up many of the beaches will be a challenge.
You know, that outer coast where we're going to have lots of storms, lots of wind, and very little access to it. Using volunteers is probably not really an option. Even with volunteers, getting them out there is going to be expensive. It's either via helicopter or on the rare days when you can actually get a boat ashore in the surf in a lot of those areas.
A proposal to fund the federal marine debris program at least $5 million a year appears stalled in Congress. Meanwhile, the Parnell administration just set up a webpage devoted to tsunami debris. It serves as a clearinghouse of information and contacts for reporting debris or helping with potential cleanup, including the corresponding state agency for every potential issue. Take, for example, impacts on wildlife. Much of that styrofoam will be nearly impossible to clean up after it's broken up by wind and wave action. Bussy Floyd says they're worried about marine mammals and birds ingesting it.
It can block their gastrointestinal tract, and the animal or bird would die from malnutrition, or they can choke on it. And it's attractive to them. The bears like to play with it, and that breaks it apart. And then the smaller animals see the little pieces and mistake it for food.
Veenstra hopes to wrap up his flying surveys by the end of August, with an analysis completed in October.
That was KTOO reporter Matt Miller in Juneau. A brown bear in a Haines neighborhood on Wednesday evening entered a residence while the family was home. According to Haines Police Chief Gary Lowe, the family on Small Tracks Road called 911 when the bear reportedly broke into the house through the front door. Reporter Margaret Fiedenauer has more.
The family remained in the upper level of the house while the bear was in the lower level. The family scared the bear away by screaming and yelling, and it was gone by the time officers arrived. Chief Lowe said there is a sow with three cubs that has been reported in the same neighborhood, entering garages and damaging property, but it's unclear if it's the same bear that entered the home on Wednesday. Lowe said his department has stepped up patrol of the area. He's also contacted Wildlife Conservation Officer Ryan Scott with the Department of Fish and Game in Juneau. Scott said he's traveling to Haines this week for several reasons, including assessing the situation with the bears in the town site.
One of the things that we need to do in town is really nail down, as best we can, which bears are doing what. And that'll really dictate, you know, any action that we'll take.
Ryan said while bears in Haines are not unusual, he's concerned the sow with three cubs has become too destructive.
You know, I consider a bear forcibly entering a house over the top. That certainly crosses the line. And it's something that I feel like we need to address. And so we'll talk about that, and we'll try to come up with a plan and, you know, whatever action that might be.
Scott said the sow and three cubs have been very mobile, traveling to several neighborhoods. He said with more wild foods becoming available in late summer and autumn, there's a chance she will move away from scavenging at homes. But, he said, it's unusual that she's been able to sustain three cubs for this long, and it's likely putting some stress on her to fatten up for winter.
It's got to be stressful on her to have, you know, she's got to feed herself, and she's, you know, she's got maternal instincts that tells her she's got to feed them as well. And here we are, we're in the second week of August, and we're coming up on the fall time, and she knows that as well. So a lot of that, certainly all those things are playing a part of this, where she feels the need to continue to feed and bulk up to support not only her own body, but three additional mouths.
He reminds residents to report any bears causing destruction to property or buildings.
If people just see bears around, that's one thing. You know, it's part of life. Living in Southeast Alaska, I think most people are used to having bears, you know, in the vicinity anyway. But certainly, if a bear is showing a lot of interest in the yard or not wanting to leave and definitely doing some damage to a building or something like that, you know, get on the phone and let the police know right away.
And most importantly, he said, keep property clear of any bear attractants. For KHNS News in Haines, this is Margaret Friedenauer.
The historic Yates Building in downtown Ketchikan is one step closer to restoration. That's after nonprofit preservation agency Historic Ketchikan signed a deal with the Episcopal Diocese of Alaska. The agreement says both groups will determine whether rehabilitation is possible. KRBD's Sarah Chicksaw has the story.
Looking at the white, brightly painted wooden siding and aluminum roof on the building next to St. John's Episcopal Church on Mission Street, you wouldn't guess it was over 100 years old. But the now unused and boarded up Arthur Yates Memorial Hospital building turned 107 this year, a year it almost faced demolition. The Yates building may be saved, thanks to the Memorandum of Understanding that was signed between the building's owners, the Episcopal Diocese of Alaska, and those seeking to restore it, Historic Ketchikan. St. John's Episcopal Church Reverend David Yaw says the Memorandum of Understanding simply means both parties have agreed to work together in good faith.
At this point, matters are very plastic, and there's not a whole lot of really solid parameters other than the fact that the building will not be sold, and the property would not be sold, and that the final decision, of course, must come from the bishop and the standing committee of the diocese.
Historic Ketchikan now can move forward with a feasibility study to see if the building is worth restoring, beginning with a grant application for state funding. Historic Ketchikan Executive Director Dave Kiefer hopes to not just save the building, but find an economically beneficial long-term use for it.
There's two tricky parts to this whole process. One is the renovation, and we've estimated, just preliminary, that you're looking at a cost of somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000 to renovate. Then part two of that is, what's it going to be? Because if there's no future use, the building will die again. And so that's actually in some ways might be a harder part of the process than simply fixing the building up.
What makes the building so special besides, well, its age?
First of all, there are very few buildings in town from that time period. There's only like three or four. Second of all, it hasn't really been appreciably changed in that time period. Most buildings in Ketchikan have been changed a lot over the years.
You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.